Yeah, I think we're live. Yes, we're good. Fantastic. All right, so we are at August 9th, morning of 10 a.m., at least here in Central European time. These time zones always move in such crazy ways. I'm never able to I always have to check, you know, whenever I coordinate with people in any other time zone, no matter what, I have to, you know, like quadruple check it, because it just, I swear, you would think it's just like a number and it's like that, but there's like all these changes that occur all the time. I know it doesn't seem like that, but there are. It's kind of floating. It doesn't really make sense. I wish they would abolish the daylight savings or whatever it's called. They've got to just eliminate that. And people are saying, what the fuck is he talking about? I know we didn't just have anything. I'm just saying, when I try to like coordinate with people, it becomes very hard. So today we have what sometimes happens when we get into our subject is I'll have this open comments thread and I'll think, oh, people are commenting but not really asking questions, and then at the end I won't get to it. I'm thinking about doing something once a week, maybe at a totally different time, like in the evening, my time, to approach subjects a certain way, or to take callers. People who like aren't necessarily saying, you know, not an expert or something, but just like a call in, right? Like a person who has question or has some, you know, question really, I suppose. Yeah. You don't really want to give people like, you know, what's your question, you know, opportunity. But, man, I tell you, the things that we are confronting all at once, it's mind-blowing when you consider the things that people lived through in the past. And, of course, some of those things are quite extreme. A lot of them really pale, especially in the past, you know, say 4, 5, 6 decades. A lot of those things really pale in comparison to the events transpiring, the contemporary events. I mean, it's really incredible. And I talk about a quickening. I talk about living in a environment where events are like speeding up, you know, the rate of change in society is very fast. And, you know, people talk about instability and, you know, when the change in society is very, very slow, but there is a need, and that's a very crazy word, because you're talking about whose need, right, to change things. You know, when you get very fast changes in society, it's going to provoke a reaction, all right? Now, historically, the Marxists and what used to be called the left used to love to use this word reactionary as like an epithet, as a cuss word. It's name calling, you know. If you're reacting to all these crazy changes and you're questioning them like, hey, wait, you know, hold on, you know, what are the ingredients? Everything by its sell-by date. You said, you know, it's no pesticides. How do we know? And in the past, there was some idea that change is not necessarily good in and of itself. Um, when you are in a crisis with no alternatives, and then there's some change, well, then, you know, maybe you're looking at an opportunity. And so to what extent have, through media, through, you know, we're talking about the social engineering, actually created a failed society to undermine that society, to destroy it in terms of its, at its foundations, what are the people? They're not beliefs at its foundation. It's not ideas. You know, what color is that idea? Can you point to an idea? Is people. Without people as the political subject, we're lost at sea. The point of a society is not to improve society. The point of society is not to improve the economy. I think what George Washington put it in terms of the relationship of government to society is that government is like this very thin golden cord, very, very thin golden cord that kind of creates the circle around this, I would say, petri dish experiment. But you have boundaries. But it's been lost in the political science. Many things have been lost in the political science. And a lot of that destruction has been driven by anger. Anger at the perceived hypocrisies in a society, while one of the real solutions is to win the battle for democracy, one of the real solutions is to also understand the limitations of government and to reject, in principle, the idea that large organizations of scale can adequately and rationally and meaningfully meet the needs of people, right? That's what we're saying. Is this is not about capitalism versus socialism, because in the 20th century, all of these societies were societies of scale. All of them were societies of the second industrial revolution, all right? One of the falterings of the Soviet Union was its orientation to the third industrial revolution and the information age. Things like a Xerox machine, and there's like these things that occur in data backup on of a data. A lot of operations were through information technology when the third industrial revolution really kicked into full gear by the 1970s. And that's what we talk about. Hey, you know that clip that's floating around where that guy, he's like a journalist or something. It's like in the 70s and he's doing, you know, I don't know if he sold the piece to 60 Minutes or something, but it's on YouTube. It's fascinating. And he's going around asking people, I think it's New York, but it's sort of like a vox populi. He just, you know, hits random people up on the street, but this is like 1975 or something. And he's saying, hey, so this is the information age, and what do you think it means? Da, 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 da. What is the information economy? What do these things mean about the information age in your life? Okay. This is the 1970s. And I swear I had a tiny little like Mandela effect moment, you know, when you're like, okay, because you're like, wait a minute. Because the way that they've rewritten it, okay, the information age is like a thing that comes in the 90s. Okay. And then that means that we're kind of barely, it hasn't really developed, and it's kind of like part of the fourth industrial revolution. And it's so important to understand that the information age is a product of the third industrial revolution. And all of that, I mean, we can unpack, but the travesty on top of the lie built into the deception is that the people that are running things right now, that the primary stakeholders in this vertically integrated corporatist network, ruling class, they think that they can manage the transition of power into a new economy based on new technologies, but also based upon them. And historically, it's the relationships that, like, the different segments of the ruling class who have different relationships to power. Their power, even though they may all wine and dine together, and even though you might hear in conversations many common things, because journalists and publications tend to speak on subjects that are pertinent to the, you know, the readers, so to speak, and it's very basic. But these industries are actually very different from one another. There are different economics to each industry, so to speak, the logistics and what it's all about and how it works and what's the game. And even though there's a limited number of games, there are more industries than there are games, and you can look at any industry and you'd be like, oh, this is this type of game. There are, you know, right, for example, there are businesses that have almost no overhead at all. Right? And then there's weird things you can do with that. There are businesses that the overhead is really, really hard to track by tax collectors. So you can do a lot of laundering through that, like laundromats. There's just so many different ways that power is connected and so many different types of agreements that when you look at what these Schwabians think, okay, is that, you know, if I knew then what I know now, we won't be overthrown, or we wouldn't have been overthrown in the past, the ruling class. But of course, this ruling class has been really unchanged for quite some time. Now, when you look at, we're talking about 300 something years, the transfer of power from the old order, it's not just the state, it's not just the class, but it was the whole paradigm, it was the entire worldview. People talk about Weltanschauung, people talk about the Gestalt, you're talking about the entire culture, the entire worldview, the entire moment and the totality of its peculiarities. I study a lot of the rise and fall of civilizations, because these are connected to the rise and fall of states, even though states are much less stable than civilizations. And civilizations, you might think of in terms of that there's continuity. So civilizations may span through many millennia and may be a civilization that has that has the continuity through its significant paradigm changes, significant paradigm shifts, right? Think about like when world leaders started to all wear the Western style, like suit and tie. We talk about soft power, right? That's an example of soft power, Western soft power, aspirational, or this is what's correct. People lost their mind. There was some meeting like maybe 10 something years ago in China or something like this, or it was the ASEAN meet and it had China, but also, you know, the South Asian countries, and it also had George Bush and others. Anyway, you know how, like when they have the meet, maybe, you know what, it was actually like a G20 meeting or something like that, that was hosted in Singapore. I don't know what, I honestly don't recall. Forgive me if it totally fucked that up, but they were all wearing traditional, you know, robes of the, you know, of the technic, of the managerial class, of a diplomat or a functionary, you know, in a court, like courtly robes. Not, no one was dressed like an emperor. They were all dressed like, you know, Confucius or whatever. And people lost their shit. And it's like, well, that's, you know, think about if that was, if China was leading the world, and then they have a paradigm shift, you know, so now they're moving into their version of the fourth industrial revolution, and they're having a paradigm shift, and they're, you know, getting into ancient culture. You know, the Chinese are taking this stuff seriously. They're not thinking in terms of, you know, financial quarters. I mean, they're thinking in terms of centuries. And that has been the, you know, primary crisis when we look at the confusion that is sowed when we in the West, we Westerners, look at the praise that people like Schwab or Gates or Trudeau might give to Chinese leaders. They are jealous of their power. They're, like, they're jealous of Putin's power, and they're jealous of the Chinese, the CCP's power, and they like it though. They hate Putin, but they like what China is doing from the perspective of what they understand. But they cannot do what China has done because they have not undergone a rotation of elites. See, they're trying to look at the things that China, they're trying to look at the things that the Chinese establishment, that the ruling class can get away with, and what they're able to do with the public. And even though every society produces dissidents, and there's different types of dissidents, from concrete, real dissidents to abstract, you know, poetic, neurotic, you know, madness dissidents, you know, throw the baby out with the bathwater, you know, only a perfect world is acceptable, you know, armchair revolutionary, ivory tower intellectual, whatever you want to, right, whatever you want to say. But the Schwabians must hold on to power. And so they're trying to look at these models, and they look at Chinese flex, and they're like, ah, the way to be like China is to flex like China. And no, that's not how it works, because China had a rotation of elites 80 years ago or something like this. Yes. So now there was probably a mid-level coup in the U.S., you know, with Kennedy's assassination. But that didn't, that wasn't a rotation of elites, okay? China has gone through three industrial revolutions in a period of 80 years. And what I've learned about the world is that, like, what we call the governments or what the governments title themselves has very little to do with the actual economic policies and social policies in those countries. For example, in Germany, you would think that after however many years, dozen, whatever, of Angela Merkel in Germany as a right pro-business party, you know, what are the Christian Democrats, was the CDU? Forgive me if I'm wrong. I haven't had coffee. I might say the opposite thing. I'm having these Joe Biden. Just by the way, yeah, I'm under cognitive load. I've been under significant cognitive load for a few months. I'm about to have, and I'm thanking God, and I'm very thankful and praying every day. I'm going to have a son, maybe in a week or 10 days born, and I have a 2-year-old. So it's double duty, triple duty, me running around, and I'm not doing most of it either. You know, my wife is amazing. It's obviously a tremendous for her. I'm not here to cry about it. I'm just saying the sleep and things like this is difficult. 5 hours accumulate. So I'm going to have to catch up on sleep and everything. So forgive if I say like some opposite thing, like if I'm talking about Hungary and all of a sudden I'm talking about Croatia, I'm probably talking about Hungary. You know, I'm just having Joe Biden moments. People are like, do you have aluminum plaque on your brain? I don't know. I don't know. Should I put like the little foot pad things and draw all the black shit from my foot? I don't know. But no, I know it's sleep. It's sleep and maybe a little dehydration. But yeah, so yeah, the Schwabians and understanding, you see, and I don't think that the problem in conservative thinking in the U.S. is that a lot of our intellectual tradition is actually based in conspirology. And I mean, a lot of the stuff that explains, you know, what's behind the bankers and what's behind the communists and is it the same thing? There's, you know, you have a lot of these kind of John Birch Society tropes, things that were also beliefs that the Nazi Party members had in Germany. Same thing, you know, that capitalism and communism were both these, nowadays you would say globalist conspiracy. Back then, they made it be about a particular Hebraic religion. And you see overlap with that, too, you know. And, you know, it's like you get these funny questions. And I don't really understand the questions. Like, why, you know, how is it that 2% of the world population, you know, in the Western countries makes up, you know, 70% of the board of directors here, 100% of the people there, 90% of the people there. You see what I'm saying? I don't know what to make of that information. I'm not, you know, am I supposed to react to it? Because if I were qualified to an opinion on that, I would lose my qualifications. And not being qualified on it, as I should be under no duress to have an opinion. I just say, well, whatever the experts say is probably true, right? Why not? They're right about everything else, aren't they? So, you know, but the issue is that when we look at the questions of the ruling class, one of the problems, and this is part of the human experience, but one of the problems that we encounter is that hyper-focusing on their crimes and hyper-focusing on things that they do can tend, if we don't make that a reflection of, oh man, I think there were times that I was close to doing that to somebody, or I think I may have, you know, obviously if you haven't stolen $5 billion, you know, from, you know, grandma's retirement from, you know, from a, from many thousands of grandma's retirements, that's a different story. You haven't done that. I get that. But you look at those things and you're supposed to say, wow, these are the conditions under which I would have had to fight to not do that. Or I've done, you know, something, I didn't do this, but when I did X, Y, and Z, you know, and there are people who think, oh, I've never done anything wrong. And there are very saintly people out there. That's true. But by and large, generally speaking, a person who says that, you know, we don't know, every given person is their own story. But, you know, generally speaking, we talk about heuristics, the red little siren goes off. Like, oh, this is not a self-reflective person. This could be a very toxic person. Looking for, you have to, anyway, what you have to understand about a lot of these ideas and the way that different beliefs, whether religious or ideological, took shape in the 20th century, it wasn't like these beliefs were really pushing the thing. They weren't really pushing it. The beliefs did shape it, but they were what was driving it was a development of new technologies and some of the first attempts to actually, and this was like with Rockefeller and oil versus the development of electric cars. I think now just in terms of mechanically, it's sufficient to say that the internal combustion very quickly developed high horsepower abilities. But that could be from what was invested into it as well. I don't know what the engineering limitations at the time were, but I knew that many of the first cars were actually electric. And but it does make sense that the car is the converter itself and not carrying around a battery. Does that make sense? So, you know, it's good to have the actual stuff in there that you're converting, I think. But nevertheless, you can see this is an early example of the technology in the shape of our society, you know, being determined by one person, by, you know, small handful of people, and what was held back and what was not put out there. We talk about the medical industry. We talk about the medical industry and this whole thing that we call doctors as if it's a profession, but the uniformity in there, which is interesting and important on the one hand, because you want rigor and you want accountability and you want to know what someone who's a doctor and what that means when they're trained and educated, you want to know what that means. Of course, it has to be consistent. But on the other hand, that drive towards standardization, right, which is a aspect of the second industrial revolution, that's when everything gets standardized. Well, you know, in the first industrial revolution, the biggest revolution at the time was called interchangeable parts or universal parts. And actually, the moves away from interchangeable parts, and like, for example, should not a alternator for a 2015 Honda Accord work in a 2020 Honda Accord if the technology hasn't been changed? Like, why would you change the bolt fittings on the component, right? Well, only to drive sales of that component. And it's very, and that's actually connected to planned obsolescence, feature novelty and other gimmicks like this. How to untangle this mess? You know, it's difficult because on the one hand, you know, people want to compartmentalize these things and they don't want to talk about things in toto. And especially when people want to argue, they have some other point in mind. They want to argue something because they're trying to make a broader point. And they want to include things that they don't have, you know, enough strong footing in the subject. And politics is one of those things that shows, you know, the problems in professionalism, the problems in all the areas of professional work and life with expertise, because the trusting the people in the white lab coat has gone terribly wrong. And, you know, as a political scientist, it can be frustrating, and but that's part of what it means. It's part of my responsibility as a political scientist. You see, having educated and worked just in that and just in politics, my opinions and my attitudes and views and what facts I think are true is reflected in that. So that doesn't mean that, I can just disregard the opinions of people who are not, because all those other people, first of all, they're human beings, and just because they don't have the background, maybe like with that dictionary, other experiences that they've had in life, and even, you know, practical or analytic and professional, lend tremendous weight into improving the political sciences. That's number one. Number two, these decisions affect us personally. So it's very much like medicine. Think about what they've tried to do with expertise in the white lab coats. Are we going to have a government of white lab coats? We've had in the past, you know, people complain about being ruled by men in black robes, like theocracies. And is the technocracy the technicians in the white lab coat? Because you have engineers. The white lab coat is really symbolic of the fourth industrial revolution. Now, we went through the third industrial revolution involves the atomic age. Okay, it involves the ability to use new types of energy besides ones already established, but plug in to a grid, so it's generating electricity. So it's interchangeable. And when you look at the sort of Pol Pot Cambodia agenda of the World Economic Forum, and how you can tell that the thinking is madness, when it could be, there's many, many ways, but you know, we have many days to talk about this, right? We can explore this. It's so important to understand. You're not going to be able to know what's happening and make decisions about what your next moves are if you don't know what they're doing, number one. And you can kind of hear people explain what they're doing and maybe take it on their authority, or they explain it, summarize it, okay, makes sense. But we're not necessarily equipped going into it with all of the ideas and background that we need to understand this. So people who speak about what the fourth industrial revolution, the Great Reset is, people who speak about it, right? And it resonates with you based upon what you already know. The issue arises that there could be a pandering to that, or an exploitation of that, because then there's the things that we don't know. And those are the things that we need to know. Okay. And by thinking that the problem with the Schwabians is that they're using Marxism, or that they're using capitalism, or that they're any of these ideologies. Okay. The names and histories of those belief systems are very important to understand. Very important. And yet, at the same time, okay, while some of those beliefs are shaping what they're planning to do, many of those beliefs are being bent and shaped to fit their needs. This has divided people for hundreds of years. Just think about how secular progressive I don't know, liberals, progressives, their attitude towards the church. Not, say, the Vatican in particular, but the church in general. Think about it towards not the institution per se, but the paradigm of that thing. And they would say, in that paradigm of religiosity, wars are responsible for... Did I say wars are responsible? No, religions are responsible for every war in human history, they will say. And this is to say that ideas are responsible for these things. And while ideas and stupid ideas are responsible, those often occur at the stupid level of the stupid decision makers, not the stupidity or the unworkability of any ideology. The thing about ideologies is that they're flexible enough to fit to the needs. In the final analysis, at the end of the day, the ideology always gets bent towards the interests of the powers that be. Okay, that's how it works. You can look at, look, and I'm just going to go out on a limb here. you can see a parallel between, say, the consolidation and bureaucratization of the early Christian church and the bureaucratization consolidation in the early Soviet Union. So you can look at like the way, you know, even early church doctors or Tertullian, you can look at early church, say in the first 5 centuries, and you can see, I know many people say early church first 3 centuries, but you know, even up to the development of Nicene Christianity into the Justinian period, right? There's a tendency to want to blame religion, of course, for every war, right? But there's also this understanding that you're not going to have, it's very difficult where you can look at the lay investiture crisis in the, was it 11th century between the papal states and the Holy Roman Empire? Hey, we're the descendants of the Franks. We gave you those. What was that Pippin's gift or what was the one? No, sorry. Was it Pippin? It was the gift of giving the papal states from the German rulers of Italy, or the Franks. I guess they're kind of like French Germans. Before there was a difference, I suppose, in the way that we think of it. So, all of those, the religion was bent to meet the needs of these kings and stuff, right? So, these emperors. I mean, realistically, were you going to have a Christianity where Romans says defile authorities, break all the rules, go against the masters, no gods, no masters? Like, they're not anarchists, right? So you can see anyway, but specifically the political geopolitical differences between East and West church, you know, what came first, right? Well, probably it was an argument about where should the money from the tithings go to. When you pass the little donations thing around, or when, you know, people walk in, I guess now people kind of give a little coin when they kiss the icon or whatever, you know, 10 cents or something like that is appropriate. 5 cents, 10 cents. You know, if you're like a gangster going to Orthodox church and you pop in a, you know, like a $50 bill or $100 bill, you're like, yeah, I'm loving God extra today. Yeah, I'm good. I'm good with the church. Oh, yeah, I know. I'm good with all of them. What is that flex? I love it. I mean, it's done conspicuously, like looking around, everyone sees you got the G note. Nah. Anyway. So, you know, and then likewise in early communism in the Soviet Union, in the first 5-6 years, they had all these power struggles. You know, you had obviously you had the Bolsheviks against the Mensheviks, and that was part of the Civil War. But then you had the power struggles within the revolutionary groups between them. They exterminate, what is it, the social revolutionaries, the Narodniks. You had the left opposition, the right opposition. Then you had the United Opposition. You know, Stalin is fighting all of these factions. He represents the center. They're the centrists, and they're fighting the extreme left of the communists, led by the left opposition, like the workers' opposition, led by Alexander Kollontai, and the left opposition. Who would that have been? But later, you know, Trotskyists think it was Trotsky always. He was almost like a right opposition. I know people think, oh, no, that was the, who was that? Oh, it's been years. Zinoviev? No, who was on the right opposition? Kamenev? Anyway, the Marxist theory was bent to meet the needs of the Soviet state. It was much more inheriting a czarist bureaucracy, repeopling it with people that had a different belief system. So really, like, the structures of the church and the structures of the czarist bureaucracy were reproduced, right? But all of the relationships between people were torn up, right? Like, all of the old social contract that was many ways broken and in many ways had not been observed or, you know, whatever. And even if it was a good one, Russia had abolished slavery. They were moving forward. Tsar Nicholas II was fairly interested in the plight of people. In other words, he wasn't part of this breakaway civilization at the time. Tsar Nicholas II, on the Romanov line. Just an interesting anomaly. I mean, some people are decent. It's interesting. His aspirations were middle class, so that's one thing biographically known about him. And he had a very middle class orientation, despite all these trappings and the position that he was born into. And that makes him more, you know, populist or more in touch by an order of several economic classes. I mean, he didn't say, I want to live like a, you know, industrial worker or, you know, an impoverished peasant, but, you know, he felt middle class and felt that that was the ideal, not what was going on with the ruling class. Very interesting. It's very interesting, actually, because the Marxists kind of make it look like these people that they're overthrowing are like the opposite or like worst case. But in fact, many of these values align and many of these things are kind of going in that direction. Looking at history of many different revolutionary processes, for example, and make of it what you will, like we're sharing these ideas, we're kind of going and we're riffing on it. And then you're finding parallels in this. You're seeing like, oh yeah, how this applies to other things. Okay. So in the Iranian Revolution, you see, it was actually the Shah before it. The Shah Pahlavi too was like the one actually working against, he was starting to turn against the British. He was starting to, he was actually hitting the hard problem of you can't be a puppet and have a sovereign state that actually functions. It doesn't make sense. You know, why would the Persians sell their oil to the British who can refine it there in Persia, in Iran, and then sell it back to the Persians at the retail price for their own oil, and the British are buying the oil from the Persians, from the Iranians, at the wholesale price? Like, this is just crazy. I mean, even to have someone else refine it for you is like, when you can do it, is almost dumb. Is almost dumb. But then to pay for it, so obviously the Shah is moving against this, and then there were these kind of things to kind of destabilize the situation, and the British were involved in destabilizing the situation to maybe like even overthrow the Shah. You see the problem, but they didn't really have a solution because he was their guy. you know, and the Russians had the communists. What was it? The communists. And then, was that Tudeh? And then the French had this interesting relationship with Khomeini, but the pivot away from the British and the pivot away from that moribund relationship occurred during Pahlavi. Okay, you can take another example, okay, with Afghanistan. After the U.S. occupation, they installed a puppet, a former ExxonMobil CEO, but he happened to be from Afghanistan, like in his whatever, until he was college age or something. He's like 50 years old at the time. And they put him as the, like, prime minister in Kabul, as he installed by Condoleezza Rice and George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld at the time, right? Well, it was only a couple of years, like three, before he was saying, the U.S. occupational forces have to leave. I mean, the fucker, like, basically was a part of the Bush administration. He was basically, you had, you know, this is Karzai, right? Ahmed Karzai. He's like, you have Bush, you know, Rice, Karzai. I mean, he was there. He was best friends with Condoleezza Rice. They were at ExxonMobil. I think they were ExxonMobil together for years. They've probably been on many trust building. I mean, how many times did, you know, Condoleezza Rice folds her arms over her shoulders and fall backwards into the arms of Ahmed Karzai during those, you know, fucking leadership building exercises and shit in fucking Yosemite. You know, on belay on, all right, and the fucking grappling ropes and shit. And then, you know, within 18 months, all Americans must be exterminated. They all must be driven from Kabul. Like, homie, you went to Harvard. Why are you doing this impression of the... So, and what I've written about, for people who want to dig further, I've written about that process. And it's basically the pull of the forces, right? The pull of the reality of your forces is greater than these cult commitments. Okay. In other words, the power is real. You understand what your power is based in there, and you can see that all politics is truly local. Anyway, these are today reflections on that. I had a questions. So Jonathan asked, wondering if you can discuss the relationship between Russian Chinese demographics and gold, if this is the primary push. The gold bug community has long believed China holds upwards of 20,000 tons of gold based on mining data and them never exporting any of it. My thoughts are if they both can upend the USD, then they truly be able to transition to enough of a service economy to maintain internal control. Same goes for Russia too. Well, obviously, you don't want to have a currency that's controlled. You need to have a sovereign currency. The way that you can do that is you would need to have built into every trade relationship a fixed exchange rate. This was one of the proposals going into Bretton Woods, but the British Empire insisted upon floating exchange rates, and that undermines the sovereignty of states. And also the psychology of gold bug should be considered separately, because that has its own velocity, its own inertia and logic that can go in many directions. Obviously people can get it right, but a lot of people get it wrong. I tend to talk to people who get it right. they don't need a service economy. That the idea that and I don't, and forgive me if I'm assuming, and but maybe I'll just use this to pivot a little. The idea that a service economy is the, you know, extension or evolution or future of all industrial productive economies is an extraordinary mythology, and it's extremely dangerous to think. It's very dumb. It's trying to, it's conflating national boundaries, which are geopolitical questions, with the process of production. Obviously, these are intimately connected, but not in the, if you describe it this way, it's very dumb, because you're limiting your criteria on upstream and downstream and or into or whole integrated aspects of production, and then you're dividing that kind of arbitrarily, separately from political questions like maybe sanctions or things that really do relate to states or wars. You're kind of considering that, not you, a person, okay, not you, Jonathan. I'm pivoting to talk about this. It's dumb to think that the jobs don't exist just because they're being done in another country. So it's dumb. It's really stupid when people talk about the service economy, okay, separately from the financialization of everything or the insurance industry, okay, those different, but just in terms of this concept of the service economy is the economy as opposed to the productive or industrial is extremely dumb, because those processes are still taking place, and the ratio of service jobs that are supported by or in turn support to some extent those industrial jobs hasn't changed the way that you would think from how they say, oh, we're a service economy. No, this, the industrial stuff is happening outside of these arbitrary, for in terms of the nature of this discussion, arbitrary national borders. That's a dumb way to think about it. Because then you could talk about the economy in a national sense, but there's no real firewalls, and it's not like the currency has to, you know, the U.S. dollar is not subject to an exchange rate when it's transacted using it, and that's the whole point. It is the reserve. It is the transacting currency globally for many countries, and Western countries last, I suppose, will hold on to it. So. The USD is, the USD has to become a weak currency, or in addition, we need a dual currency system, like the Chinese have. I know that we kind of every time that you talk about M1, M2, M3, every time you talk about different types of currency, you're talking in a sense about different types of currencies, but artificially, intentionally, to have a currency for large scale or international industrial transactions of scale is, you could have one currency and a domestic currency for another is just one, but that can even get messy. There's a lot of room for dumb games in there, but the direction, I know it's hard for people to understand or to hear, but it's actually going to make them, I want to say, happier and wealthier in numerous ways than one over time, a short time, that the U.S. dollar is going to be weak. And weak dollar policy was the real policy of Trump. I was talking about this in 2015. But it's not, these are, It's a little narrow to talk about just in terms of weak or strong dollar. It's like in what ways and things like this. The devil's in the details, and the way it's done is obviously the most important thing. But just in the most general way, you want to discourage outsourcing and you want to increase exports. Overall, you're going to need a weak dollar to do that. So there are no problems. There are only different opportunities. Next, turning the page from Steve Ramsey asks, just an observation. Well, okay, that's a good, okay. thank you for the warning. Question from Gordon Halov. No, not a question. Well, you know, I've said to people who are listeners that I would recognize that if that on the subject, if you have a question to interact upon, you know, we could talk. Question. The lines between government and corporations are increasingly blurred. What's the use of elections? Isn't it just window dressing? Well, yeah, by and large, they are, but the lines between government and corporations being blurred is, of course, an aspect, but you still have, you need to have political competition. There are still enough differences between what the elites are doing, not just between government and corporations, but within government or within the corporate world. I mean, there's corporations and there's banks and there's different types of things. There's different types of big business that, you know, runs government, right? And the fundamentals of those different big businesses are at odds with each other. So I would say that in fact, elections are more important now than they've been at any time more recently. I mean, in the last, say, 20 years ago or 30 years ago, in the Western countries, at least, they're more important now. And they can produce certain results. Just think about it like this. Think about the amount of election fraud or if you will, campaign financing that goes into shaping the things and into trying to control the outcome of elections. If those elections outcomes were not important for the ruling class, like in other words, if they simply merely had, you know, do everything through Davos or through the Trilateral Commission or through the, you know, whatever, okay, Bilderberg Group, and then that's their parliament, right? Then what use of government? Yet there's a big fight over government. So that's a good clue that the level of specificity matters in discussing any matter in detail. If we stop our question at the generalities, like they're all just people in pursuit of power, so why does it matter? You know, you see what I'm saying? It's like, well, there's many opportunities that arise in their conflict, you know, in the fight between these titans. And they can weaken each other when they fight each other. And either one of them at any given time is going to be in a very difficult situation, and it's going to have to appeal very practically to the broad masses of people on an aspect of what the people want. There's always an angle for power. We're just talking about representative power. We're talking about power brokering. As long as the game of politics is open, you're going to avoid extreme violence in the streets and extreme social violence. And it's a real fight that it's over. That doesn't mean that a lot of the races aren't fake or the candidates in many races are picked, but there's definitely, you know, that's where all the details are. But it's a very good question. Let's see. Good morning. I have read very different conflicting statements about Russian military capabilities and value dollars compared to the U.S. Is it in the region of 300 million or in the billions? I can appreciate what I can access online, but what do you think is a closer reflection of the truth? Thanks. This is a very good question. I can answer very briefly in about 15 seconds. I'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. Yeah, no sponsor, but yeah, so, you know, it's apples and oranges. When you compare military budgets, it's pointless to do. The dollar amount diamond is never going to tell anything because the United States military industrial complex sells $140 toilet bowl seats for aircraft carriers. Now, it's functionally identical and there's no design improvement or anything to the $10 one at Walmart. This is a very typical practice in the US military. So saying what they spent in billions means nothing. It means nothing because those aren't reflective of costs. So it just doesn't, there are figures that give you information and then there are figures that confer no transferable valuable information based on the figure. Okay. What you just want to look at is more the, not the dollar value, but use online resources that you can access to just look at what pieces they have, like how many aircraft carriers, how many tanks, how many this, how many that, and then look at what they have and then look at what the quality of those are, you know, how does this plane compare to this plane, or what is the, how are these used, you know, and what are the doctrines on the use of these, you know, do they use tanks as motorized infantry, or do they use them as motorized cavalry, or do they use them as mobile artillery? You see what I'm saying? For example, like as a cannonade, mobile cannonade, or what do they use? Those are really the questions. The dollar amount, because it's, everything's going to be inflated in the U.S. because of the arms industry. It's basically a stock market subsidy. It's socialism for the rich, and it's a stock market subsidy system. And so they give all this extra money on top of, they give 10, 20, 30 times more money than necessary to build the thing. And then those people who get all that extra money then are investing a known government-driven, known quantity amount of dollars into certain stocks. That so they the money that gets print, the money that goes through the military industrial complex, a lot of it winds up back in the stock market. So it's impossible to really know. Okay. I mean, it's not impossible to really know. You would really just look at, okay, here's the average salary. This is the hourly. This is the materials. This is the production cost. And it would be, you know, 1/10 what they sell it for, or 1/100 in the case of toilet seats. You see the thing? That's the problem. All right, turning the page. Desmond Knox, the question is how Russia manages Ukraine after the operation ends. Millions will be affected, infrastructure, energy, pensions, so forth. Uh-huh. Does Russia have to support a failed state to avoid massive risk? If not, I do see benefits also. Yeah. Enhanced GDP, yeah. No, not a mixed bag. This is definitely a plus. I mean, Russia has a theory about the fourth industrial revolution and how that is managed, okay? And it's based upon an accurate understanding of where the human mind exists relative to AI. Even in a most nightmare dystopic scenario today and based upon the actual existing technologies moving forward, foreseeably for 150 to 200 years, AI is nowhere going to approximate human cognitive abilities, period. That means that, so I have other reasons to think that Russia is doing something pretty interesting and not in an evil way, but even if you were evil and not retarded, or have this part of the question wrong, for reasons that we talk about the paradigm, and being impossible to see the solution, even seeing that you can't see. This is why we make reference to the dark Gnostic Platonic film, Dark City. Russia does not have to support Ukraine, not because it's not obligated to or would be, and not because they aren't going to be running it, they will be, but Ukraine is a failed state today because of the political crisis, which led to the necessity of the special military operation. It is not a failed state because of its economic fundamentals. It's very wealthy in raw materials, has a lot of also developed industries and a strong economic complexity index, and could even be stronger without any substantive investment at all. Rather, you're talking about a reorganization of existing assets. Ukraine is a society that has a very high college education rate, at least if the graduating rate today is not as high as it was 30 years ago, many of those people educated at times of a higher rate are still relatively young and have 20 and 30 years of work to expect from them in their technical fields, in their management, in their industries. And Ukraine actually has all the foundations to be, in fact, a very wealthy country. It's so important, and here's the sadness, is that the Ukrainian nationalists and on the far right, be they so wrong on so many important questions of life and history, are correct about this much. Actually, the only real failed state that doesn't have the foundations for to be its own country are Galicia. You see, that's what adds such insult to injury, that the origins of this kind of Nazi thinking in Galicia. Now, we know that Nazism today in Ukraine is broader and not based in the specificities of the Galician instantiation in the past, and there's more broad cultural neo-Nazism that's developed as part of a contrived political milieu and subculture out of the Western countries through the intelligence agencies. Talk about Gladio B, Gladio B, as in A, B, C, but there's just A and B, but just Gladio and Gladio B. And this is basically the activation and integration of the Nazi elements in the Warsaw Pact countries. If Gladio was to integrate into the intelligence and operationalize the Nazis from France and Italy, etc., Gladio B was part of the Cold War. Anyway, so I'm looking at the questions here. Very good. Yeah, so FBI, Trump, it's huge. This is a very dangerous part of politics. Trump is going to win massively from this. I don't know who Trump was able to get in the FBI to Roger Stone him like this, but right when people were thinking, you know, that, hey, you know, maybe he's kind of part of this game, you know, people who voted for him twice, some of them may be thinking like, hey, you know, maybe he's part of this game. I mean, they didn't just knock on his door. This is a brutal military assault, tactical assault on a peaceful civilian. Militarization of the FBI, you know, Mormon households vary in their Mormon households kind of vary in their liberality, but they tend not to be places that are where young gay people can feel like accepted. But, you know, every culture and every religion, and Mormon, some of it is almost like, because of the integration of it, has some subcultural elements to it. There's a uniqueness there's a Mormon household we can speak of, for example, categorically. That's what we're talking about. And it seems that the FBI has been established or you know, serves, we talk about it from the perspective of Durkheim's functionalist sociology. So you don't have to approach everything from like a conflict perspective like the Marxists do necessarily, or you can just kind of explain things from a bird's eye view. Even though people might think that they're engaged in a conflict, from a bird's eye view, this is just like how the system works. This is just the you're just looking at the metabolic process of the digestion tract and the mastication of the food or whatever. You're just looking at the organism. You're looking at the process of its organs. And sometimes there's disruption, and sometimes there's, you know, shortages, or the blood does this and the enzyme produces here, and then there's inflammation. But it's all part of a body. You see what I'm saying? So if we're in a society, the Marxists kind of think that all of the social classes, even though they're part of the same society, that the different socioeconomic classes have such different interests that they must violently clash into each other. I mean, they don't make them do that, although agitators by the state pretending to be communists often do, and so anti-communist thinking that tries to make it seem like the communists are saying that everyone should be divided into classes is not correct. They're saying that, just like in Federalist Papers and political theory long contemplates, that there's different socioeconomic classes that have different interests, right? So, but that doesn't mean that billionaires like Trump have the same interest like 200 billionaires like Elon Musk. And the small billionaires and multi-multi-millionaires can see that there's an attempt for a smaller group. I mean, this is ongoing. This is not new information for them. It's not like, oh, here's a new thing we just realized. I'm just saying, from our summarizing heuristics and kind of simplification and kind of narrative, just to understand what's happened, is that big millionaires like 700 million and four billionaires, like I have 4 billion or whatever, can see that the direction that these people these $100 billion people, $200 billion people want to go with things, it would represent a very realizable coup against them, their own position as well. And that pushes them to turn to the people, to arm the masses, you see what I'm saying, and say, because to exist in a political environment where you've made some kind of great society with the people is a far better outcome, where you're, and you are the game in town, you are now the ruling class, is a far better outcome than to be destroyed by the monopolists who are part of a cult. I mean, you know, this we talk about the Zaibatsu socialist monstrosity, the government created entities like Bill Gates and Elon Musk. I mean, we say government, but the corporate, you know. So, yeah, now Trump, hey, he got raided, dude. They did him dirty. They did him nasty like Roger Stone. So people are going to love him again. But the demographics of Russia and China, the end of globalization, multipolarity, well, that's what we talk about here. I was talking about multipolarity like regularly a decade ago. I was talking about multipolarity when they were trying to say that geopolitics is a Nazi field. And you spell it with a K, and it's a Nazi field. And the idea of multipolarity is a Russian spooky dooky Dugin conspiracy of Russian Nazism. Okay, that's how far back I go with multipolarity. No, but multipolarity has been misdefined. It's been misunderstood. It's been completely. There are different definitions of multipolarity, and the U.S. institutional definition was at odds with the one that is used. Like, if you read anything, any, like, analysis white paper from any think tank globally today, talking about scholars or, you know, peer-reviewed journals and stuff, articles, anywhere in the world, when they talk about multipolarity, what they're talking about are sovereign and independent capital nodes arising in the capital-centric regions of the world, and then the overlay between that and sort of a mutually shared culture. Like, so you have, obviously, you have Mexico and Brazil as these extremely dynamic economies in Latin America, extremely wealthy minerals, highly educated workforce, complex economies, high complexity index, and things like this. So it makes sense that these would emerge as in a sovereign way. It would make sense that that Japan and China come closer together. It would make sense, all of these things. It makes sense that Russia and Europe go closer together. It makes sense that all, you know, these, you know, sub-Saharan Africa or West African states come closer together. The North African states come closer together. So Africa's maybe like 5-4, you know, but Africa is huge. It's, by the way, it's like has many continents, like many countries and land masses can fit inside of Africa. Like looking at Africa, for example, is like covering the whole side of the planet or whatever on that model. is giant. So, but multipolarity in Africa is probably, you know, four regions that form into two, with the Sahara being the dividing line, but really North Africa, probably even more like part of Europe and Mediterranean. It's very interesting to see how that will work out, but that's what's meant by multipolarity. Okay. Now, in U.S. literature, there's a breaking point, and there was all this growing pain and fits and bullshit and everything. But in American literature, multipolarity meant the system immediately after the end of the collapse of the Soviet Union, and calling that new system multipolarity because the U.S. This is just so dumb. This is so dumb. It almost hurts my fucking brain to recite this. And it's hard to remember because it's hard to remember wrong facts or bad information. Okay? But multipolarity in this old stupid fucking definition was that the United States will have to push on and rely upon more global partners in pursuit of its new security position vis-a-vis global terrorism. That, in other words, now the issues in the world are no longer state versus state, but oh my God, 9/11, look, it's a plane. And that multipolarity means that we need to have greater integration of the U.S. and U.K. intelligence services into Five Eyes, and it with Australia, New Zealand, Israel, Canada. It's the A5 plus I. Or Five Eyes. I would say Six Eyes. So that has been the anyway, give me 15 seconds. I gotta see what this disruption is. All right, we're back. What were we talking about? Oh, right. So that's why in U.S. doctrine, when they talk about multipolarity, they mean something else. I'll give you an example. Look at, if you have, for example, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley. And if you read his paper from, I know the bullshit I end up looking at. If you read his paper from for officer school, it was postgraduate work, and he writes in a very plain English small sentence way that is preferred for military writing, even on some more complex matters. And so this is written like in 1993 or something like this, 94. It's internal training. He's already military, and this is to advance. So this is like some additional academic work that he did at fairly prestigiously as well. And I guess the summary of the abstract would be that he's talking about American geopolitical strategy and its relationship, its profile, international relations in a multipolar world, okay? And then he begins to describe what this multipolarity is, and it's saying that multipolarity is American leadership in the post-Cold War, you know, what they were calling bipolar world, which is kind of crazy because bipolar, you know, personality disorder, the funny term, the bipolar world, you know, during the Cold War. Then multipolarity, okay, so that was like in the 90s. Then the term multipolarity starts to mean the U.S. and China, but not recognizing that China is a pole, and this is before recognizing that Russia turned out to be more sovereign than they were gambling, I guess is the way to conclude that. Russia turned out to be a whole lot fucking more sovereign than they were gambling upon. I think those odds were looking pretty bad anyway for the past, since 2008, 2012. But anyway, multipolarity is also not a Chinese or Russian plot. Just like globalization was not a Chinese or Russian plot. If you want to find out where the craziness in our thinking is, just look at our own political class and look at the grifters and all the commenters. Are they called commenters or commentators? I always call them commentators. All of these commenters I like commentator. I'm going with commentator. They get away with misleading and misinforming people because, you know, a lot of, think about the effort that's put into just the marketing of the show and having the right voice and the right timing and the production, post-production, show production. Peter Zayn or anyone else, it's not looking at the, you know, there are just people that are just insanely prone to blame everything on other countries. It's an extension of blaming other people for things in your life, but blaming these other countries is a huge pastime in the U.S. Now it's liberals that hate Russia, but before it was conservatives that hated Russia, like during the Cold War. And the things that the conspiracy in the past, the anti-Russian conspiracy and the anti-Chinese conspiracy in the past, is that they were behind globalization because globalization was global communism, because communism was a one-world order. Anyway, so we've deconstructed that in the past. We won't need to again. Turning the page. Thanks for the question. Why do you think Latvia and Lithuania are so vocal and so open in their hatred towards Russia? Just read what they want to ban visa. Because, yeah, right. What's their game? Just a spite or something bigger? The political opportunity exists. Politics is primarily a game of politics and risks. The arguments and the positions are going to flow along the area of that you can agitate a public, that you can come at them with a message that reflects their anger and redirects their anger about the conditions, the stupid and deplorable corruption in Lithuania and Latvia and Estonia as well, in these failed, unsupportable, unjustified, non-historical, propped up Frankenstein monster, welfare state infused formaldehyde countries that in any real world system that wasn't based upon the idea of one state, one vote at the UN, let's say, as that's our fundamental concept of states, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia would either be Germany, Poland, or Russia. So, you know, it's not reflective of any, look, there's no true fucked up psyche to Latvians or Lithuanians that's that profoundly dysfunctional, you know, behind nothing more beyond the kind of colloquial things and the things that people would observe and the kind of cute things or charming or stubborn or whatever, just a people, nothing toxic or problematic about any of these Baltic state people, okay? It's, you can see, just like in the U.S., if the transatlanticists, right, if this cabal has an agenda, there's going to, and that agenda is appealing maybe to 5% of the population, that's going to, they're going to get, there's going to be grifters and politicos and talking heads and fucking people who think that politics is just like real estate and the stock market and it's just about what you can get for free and get other people's to work and do for you. And, you know, they treat it like it's, you know, like it's a game where you're gaming. They treat politics like you're gaming, you know, on the lack of, you know, on hazard, on moral hazard. So that's the thing. It's just, it's not like, oh, these people are demented or they've been whipped into a frenzy. No, they'll be unwhipped, you know, under a new government. Like if there are big changes happen in the region and suddenly magically, you know, Lithuania, Estonia, Latvia were neutralized, they were denazified, you know, you would have more support for, and I'm saying a plurality. I'm not saying, oh, everyone loves Russia, but you would have more support. Like 20-30% of the population would really support a pro-Russian government in any of those states more than the 10% of people that actually support the full agenda of these crazies in control of those countries today. Even if they're like, well, we're not Russians, and even if they're like, well, my great grandfather was a Nazi conscript or whatever, kind of, and we like some things about the, I mean, you know, people are complex. They got, you don't really pick your grandparents and stuff, and it's ancient history by the time you're born. But that's, you know, people, you know, grandparents, some of them were in these Nazi armies and stuff. But a lot of other people, like almost everyone's parents and stuff were, you know, in some kind of Soviet system and stuff. And they have a lot of experience in dealing with Russians. And, you know, I know my Russian listeners would understand, Russians are difficult people. you know, but I mean, it comes with all people of great power, of great the peoples of great power, you know, that sense that you have a good way of doing things, or that your management process, or that you're, you know, that you individually, you know, that the triumphs of your civilization are conferred upon you individually, and like the things that your country does well are also like aspects of your own personality. Like, oh, you know, we're very, like Germans being, let's say, you know, technical and precise and rational or something like this. It's like, well, some of you are. Most of you just get into bar fights and, you know, coal miners and shit. But yeah. Very good. So yeah, that's been, and I know there was maybe a question that I didn't answer. I had wanted to, I think I did from the other day. Okay, good. Yeah. And I also caught up on them. Sweet. All right. That's a wrap. Thanks for being with us. I'm going to get yesterday's and today's up on the drive. I don't know what the title of this one. Give me an idea what this show should be called besides Total Shit. All right, late.